Francesca Hong surprised a lot of people in Wisconsin by leading the Democratic field for governor in the Marquette poll, albeit with just 14% of the vote among registered Democrat voters.
And even with a very crowded field, the candidate who wins the Democratic primary August 11th will need a lot more support than that.
Still, it's better to be ahead than behind. But can a Democratic socialist who represents the ultra-progressive Madison Isthmus in the legislature really have a shot at winning the governor's job statewide?
Hong's secret weapon could just be her authenticity.
We're going to talk to Hong about her campaign and strategy to win on today's Center Stage with Milford and Hands, the Wisconsin State Journal's political podcast from the Sensible Center of Wisconsin Politics. I'm Scott Milford. I'm the opinion editor at the State Journal.
And I'm Phil Hands. I'm the editorial cartoonist at the Wisconsin State Journal.
And we are two-fifths of the Wisconsin State Journal editorial board.
The more authentic two-fifths.
Francesca Hong, welcome to Center Stage with Milford and Hands. You're running for governor. We know you somewhat well as the state representative from the Madison Isthmus and East Side. You got your start in the restaurant business, right?
Correct.
So one thing I wondered was, how has a restaurant business prepared for you? What are the skills that sort of apply to politics from there?
I think in my time working as a line cook, server, dishwasher, it's where I learned the importance of working as a team and being prepared for service, while also recognizing that the variable is the customer. And working in restaurants means you have to be able to adapt, respond to different crises, whether it's getting backed up on tickets or someone not calling in for work. And owning a restaurant, that's where I learned a lot about managing by creating a culture where folks respected every position in the restaurant, that people felt like they had a purpose in being a part of the restaurant. And it's very much where I learned the importance of fostering leadership around me, that wherever folks went after they worked at Morris Ramen, that they were going to be successful.
In this metaphor, are the voters the customers? Are we the variable?
I hadn't thought about it like that before, Phil. I'm gonna marinate on that. But I think one more thing is that there is an unmatched hustle to our service industry workers, and I'm bringing a lot of that hustle to the campaign trail.
Do you still do a shift periodically?
Oh, yes. I've offered and actually asked a lot of my fellow restaurant owner and chef friends that if they need someone to cover in the dish pit, I'm excited and would be happy to. But I've had a couple bartending shifts during the campaign.
I imagine the skill of bartending comes in handy in terms of being able to talk to people and be engaging.
Yes. Engaging with folks, learning to be a good active listener, and multitasking, being very conscious of what's happening around you and being perceptive to the different interactions that are happening in the bar and looking out for anyone who might be belligerent and has enough, knowing when to bring in support and make sure all the customers are having a good time and being safe.
What was your take on the whole tax on tips? I know it was something popularized by Donald Trump, who you're not a fan of, but still it affected restaurant workers a lot, bartenders. What's your take on that?
It's bad policy. I find it to be a gimmick. I think it impacts state revenue coming in and doesn't actually address the broader issue of, lower pay for service industry workers. We should be talking about, abolishing the tipped minimum wage, increasing the minimum wage, ensuring that there are clear rules on tip share, that instead of policies that are talking about reducing your taxes, that we should be talking about keeping more money in your pockets, and that you get to make more money. So I was glad to see the governor veto it when it came to the floor. I was very concerned about what it meant for the state's fiscal situation, because what was in the surplus spending bill would have made that policy permanent, as opposed to at the national level where it sunsets.
Was that well received by the restaurant community that you're enmeshed with, that you know a lot of people? Were they disappointed that you weren't for that because it would have been some money right away, or not?
I don't believe our office got a single response about my vote. I've been talking to different restaurant owners when the policy was enacted through the federal government. And honestly, it's burdensome that they have to make additional adjustments to payroll and tax filing. And it's the conversation should be about increasing wages and addressing this on a systemic level. And this, it doesn't broadly bring in more money for service industry workers who are already vastly underpaid and shouldn't have to just rely on tips.
So you said you were in favor of raising the minimum wage. What would be a fair minimum wage?
I think we have to start at $20 an hour, which is not a living wage for most municipalities in the state. And to have a plan to phase it in for some of our smaller businesses. And I think we can set the timelines based on number of employees or revenue coming in. 99% of the small businesses, or 99% of businesses in our state, are small businesses, but a lot of businesses already start at $20 an hour. And we wanna make sure that we're leveling the playing field and that we're protecting all workers from potential bad actor employers.
Would you want a separate minimum wage for restaurant workers currently? I mean, currently they have a separate wage. Would you oppose that? I mean, you mentioned you didn't like that, right?
I think moving towards higher minimum wage and looking at where there can be tip share, but I think a lot of restaurant workers want to be able to not only make a living wage, but have access to good benefits. And when there are social insurance programs like paid leave, childcare, and healthcare, these are policies that help small business owners as well. When small business owners have to compete with larger corporations that are more easily able to offer these benefits, that when there is support from the state, like a public option, it helps with worker retention, worker health, and making sure that, I would be happy to continue working in the service industry. It's who I am, it's what I love. I think we're built different, but not everyone sees it as a career. And if we have these state insurance programs and we're increasing wages and we're supporting our small businesses, that independent restaurants and bars, taverns, we'll be able to maybe not just sustain, but also scale. And I think that worker health is ultimately good for the small business health and their bottom line.
You led the poll that came out from Marquette University at 14%. Of course, the top candidate was at 65-ish, and that was undecided. They weren't sure who to support. But still, I was surprised that you were at 14%. I was surprised that you were winning, that you were ahead of the other candidates. Were you surprised at all?
I was pretty neutral. I believe in not being complacent and ensuring that we are campaigning as if we're behind every day, and that the hustle and growing our volunteer community, ensuring that my staff are taken care of here on the campaign, and that we're building on the over 250 events that we've held all across the state since we launched in September. Those numbers are there. It's good to see, but the numbers I care more about are the number of individual donations and unique donors, and making sure that we're staying ahead there and being grassroots and community powered. And but I guess sometimes the poll numbers help with making sure that some folks that might be a little skeptical or surprised know that we're taking our campaign very seriously, and we hope they pay attention too.
What percent of the vote do you think you need to win in August to become the nominee?
No, I would like to see, I'd like to see the percentage of Democratic votes across all different counties for us to be ahead. I think we're looking at, around 26, 27% of the vote in order to feel comfortable. And that's, that'll fluctuate based on how many candidates are still in the race on August 11th.
In that same poll, I noticed that the respondents who identified as Democrats, 91% of them said they were very concerned about inflation and the cost of living. So if that is the top issue, what does a Governor Hong do for people with that concern?
Lowering costs means giving people more choices in what they can do with their money, because there's more accessible services that they're paying too much for now that are available through social insurance programs at through the state. So when we have, we're working towards free childcare, and because families right now are paying up to 30, sometimes over 30% for childcare, and we want that number to be at 7%. So ensuring that providers and families are able to have affordable, accessible childcare means that there's more money that they're able to save and use towards, hopefully, thinking about even vacation, getting some rest. It means healthy school meals for all. That could save a family of four up to $1,800 a year when there are free breakfast and lunch at school for all schools. Like, our bill was, K-12 public schools, private schools, school for the visually impaired. It means having fairer, cheaper healthcare through the state, with both the expansion of Medicaid and growing a public option, and looking at pilot programs for where we can offer more state insurance to people across Wisconsin and continue to compete in the marketplace, bring in competition to the healthcare marketplace, and start working on making healthcare costs lower. It means lower property taxes by funding our schools and moving towards a formula that isn't reliant on property taxes to fund schools and raise revenue limits. And it means, policies like paid leave, where workers don't have to choose between taking care of a loved one, a new baby, an aging parent, and, having to go to work. And so these are policies that I think allow folks to make fewer difficult decisions about what they have to do about, what's coming into the household. And the other big piece, I know a lot of folks talk about increased food prices. And one of the ways we can address that is shortening our supply chains while also supporting our small farms and ensuring that our Wisconsin farmers are feeding people again, and working on programs where there's contracts, partnership between local family farms, whether it's produce, pork, chick, poultry, beef, dairy farms are able to get subsidies from the state in order to be able to provide healthier, nutritious, Wisconsin-grown food to mm-hmm. different families and compete again in that marketplace, because they're not beholden to prices that are set by Big Ag and their suppliers. We're feeding more Wisconsin families from Wisconsin farmers, and that's going to lower costs. We saw that during COVID.
I think of the Social Democrats as having high level of services, but also high level of taxes. Would that be accurate for a Hong administration?
I think it's about fairer taxation system. Think about ensuring that, when we've had a Republican majority working or trying to achieve a flat tax. Right now, we have some of our lowest income earners paying a higher percentage of their income in taxes than the highest tax bracket. It's easier to find corporate loopholes and get corporate tax breaks than where they're, you know, larger corporations are paying a lower tax rate than some of our small businesses because of things like the manufacturing agricultural tax credit. So investing in social insurance programs to help lower costs or make financial decisions easier for working class folks means fair taxation for both corporations and making sure that some of the wealthiest are paying their fair share. We shouldn't, everyday people shouldn't be having to pay a higher tax rate than some of the wealthiest, most privileged in our state.
What would you envision for people who have more money in Wisconsin? You know, who's rich and how high would the tax rate go? Would you like it to go?
Yeah, it's to help lower property taxes by up to 44%. I introduced legislation that would that would add an additional tax bracket for the starting at $1 million in income, and then increase the tax rate for billionaire income, as well as incorporating a wealth tax, but that would only go up 0.7%, and we can invest that revenue back into special education reimbursement and help lower property tax costs for folks across the state.
Okay. So you represent the Madison Isthmus, the east side, not quite to my house. You're a few blocks away. I looked it up today. And Phil's over on the near west side. But across the state, that's considered pretty much as blue as it gets. Sometimes 9 out of 10 voters will vote for the Democratic nominee. So how do you make that sort of left-wing reputation of the Isthmus play statewide?
Well, first, I'll say that I've knocked doors and encountered Republican constituents before. Was an interesting conversation around COVID closures and abortion. But, you know, my story and my current living situation, being a renter and a service industry worker, in addition to a legislator and a single mom, you know, that's really what differentiates me in this field. And it also gives me an opportunity to connect with folks all across the state as they see me as, you know, the working class person, the everyday person, because I am. And I don't think that I'm better than anyone else. And we're able to talk about everything from, you know, hood vents. I've talked to folks, I was at a bar in Blanchardville, and I noticed, you know, I asked them how old the flat top was, what sort of hood vent system they had. When I was in Marinette, there's this Mickey Lou's is the restaurant. And I asked the servers and the cook if I could just sneak back there and look at their brick oven where they cooked the burgers with fire. Talking about being in the restaurant industry, being a single mom, having worked with farmers and what it's like for small farmers right now. In rural areas, I have an opportunity to really connect with folks. And I think one of the problems for Democrats has been, you know, there is an elitism. We've seen that the majority of, especially during primaries, the higher propensity voters are white, college educated. And a lot of people in Wisconsin feel very left behind. And when they're, this is where maybe the messenger matters more than just the message. So when I'm talking about building permanent affordability and lowering costs, it's because that's what's at stake for me too. And, you know, I remind folks that when I got elected in August, one of the first things I did was get the hell out of Dane County and started, you know, supporting and meeting other candidates running for the assembly in communities very different from my district. And whether that was in Platteville or Hudson, I was in, I think it was Nina, Wausau. It was interested COVID campaigning times, but we did things like cooking demos and knock doors. I think that I also mentioned that being the first Asian American legislator, I've been invited to attend different festivals, like the Hmong New Year festivals in different parts of the state, asked to speak at schools about my experiences being the first, and for the first two sessions, the only Asian legislator. And that's also where I got to talk to folks who were in very different communities than my own. And there are many similar struggles, stresses, and people are tired. And I share that fatigue with them. And I want them to know, though, that they've got someone who is hustling every day to make sure that there's a fighter in the governor's office and someone who's willing to not just fight for them, but fight alongside them.
There is a precedent for a woman living on the isthmus and winning statewide, and that's Tammy Baldwin. I actually used to live about a block away from her. That was 25 years ago. It seems, though, to win statewide, she's moderated some her view, or maybe it's a pivot, or maybe it's just recognizing that your constituency is much broader. But I'm thinking of, say, being in favor of the F-35s, being okay with wolf hunting. Those were a couple things that generally Madison was pretty wound up about and against a lot of people on the isthmus were. So do you see yourself pivoting to some degree in this race from maybe one constituency to another, or is it a linear line?
You know, Senator Baldwin has, she's won some close races, and we're following her campaign strategy of trying to do everything and be everywhere. She's actually a constituent. But in this current political moment, in this political climate, I think that folks are more receptive to someone who is an outsider, someone who is willing to challenge the establishment within both the Democratic and Republican Party. And I take strong stances, even if they may be politically uncomfortable. I think it's important to democratize discomfort a little bit when we're in these times and a lot of people are demanding change. So I wouldn't say it's linear, except that, you know, I try to show where my values are and where I stand on things like bombing innocent children and civilians. Are tax dollars going to fund, you know, genocide and wars? When it comes to prioritizing our kids with policies that I support and have legislation that I've introduced, and that, you know, this is a state that I'm born and raised and I'm incredibly proud of, and I'm concerned about what the state is going to look like for my son and for all kids in Wisconsin. And no matter what the zip code is, Wisconsinites, we show up for one another, neighbors show up for neighbors, even if maybe they didn't vote for the same person, especially in rural areas. That's something that's really special and that folks are proud of in those communities. So I try to lead with my values, show my values in the policies that I'm prioritizing, and take stances that maybe could be politically uncomfortable for others, but I think it's important to lead with moral clarity.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of uncomfortable stances, CNN has just revisited your comments from the past about defunding the police as a first step towards abolishing the police, and that the police exist to uphold white supremacy. Have you changed your view on the police in the last 5 or 6 years, or is that still pretty much where you stand?
Look, I don't like fucking crime. I want safe streets. I want to be able to hold law enforcement who abuse power accountable. I want everyone in Wisconsin to feel safe. I think we want to talk about who's been defunding the police. It's that the Republican majority in the legislature has had flat levels of shared revenue so that our municipalities are forced to make cuts to their city and town budgets. I want to invest in what prevents crime. Community centers where youth can go and have things to do, have fun after school, investing in out-of-school programs, great public parks, libraries, and fully funded schools. If you look at the neighborhoods that have the lowest crime rates, they have their, the communities have stable housing, good public services, city services like EMS and, you know, fixing potholes because there's, you know, stable shared revenue. This is where I'm willing to work with whomever across the state, collaboratively with representation from all different sectors to make sure that we're making Wisconsin a safer place to live.
So a Governor Hong wouldn't abolish police.
I think that is not something that the governor is going to be able to do, and it's something that's, you know, can be achieved in my lifetime, my kids' lifetime, or my grandchildren's lifetimes. It's our administration is going to be working closely with local government officials to ensure that their budgets are, there's equitable shared revenue so that they don't have to be forcing cuts for essential services. And again, we have to be investing more in what has been shown, proven through data and studies that prevent crime, and that's investment in our kids and making sure people have basic needs met.
So it sounds like you would be in favor of increasing shared revenue to lots of these municipalities, and in some way, maybe increasing funding for police.
I think a lot of our municipalities have had to make cuts to public safety programs. And, you know, there's increasing shared revenue is absolutely a priority of mine. And we are a local control state. And we have seen in previous shared revenue legislation where the state is preempting things like what happened in Milwaukee in terms of what, you know, what was contingent on them getting the ability to increase sales tax. And I think that, you know, those decisions at the local level, municipalities will be able to make, they won't be forced with decisions on, you know, bad decisions and worse decisions when it comes to having to cut essential services. I'm not interested in, you know, in making cuts from the state level arbitrarily when it comes to how communities determine you know, what is necessary to keep their communities safe. I want everyone to feel safe. I think that's a right to be able to feel safe.
You've got some attention for some of the foul language, the F-bombs. I heard one a little bit earlier. Phil and I, you could probably go back and listen to some podcasts, and we might have used one or two in the past. I don't remember if I bleeped it out. But occasionally it does seem like it gets nasty. There was the one time with the Tavern League where you used the C word against them. And I thought, wow, that seems a little like our politics are going downhill rather than being civil.
Kind of Trumpy.
And I know there's a lot of people on the other side who aren't very civil, but what about that? Was that a mistake to use a C word in the Tavern League?
Yeah, that was after my primary, before I was inaugurated, before inauguration. And, you know, I am a fan of alliteration. And there are a lot of concerns, decisions, influence that the Tavern League has on our politics and on our politicians. There's a lot of frustration around that from the restaurant and tavern industry and taverns who aren't members. You know, I, especially in these times, focusing on decorum as opposed to improving working class people's lives, I think is a little misguided. I think an appropriate response to what is happening in our country is a little, some foul language is okay. I have older women friends who have expressed concern, my mother included, about swearing less. And, you know, within a couple of months now, I talked to another friend. She lives out in Greenfield, and she's dropping some colorful language. And so has the governor of Michigan and our own governor. We've gone from holy mackerel to bullshit. So maybe I'm a trendsetter.
Legislatively, what would you say has been your biggest accomplishment in your time in the legislature so far?
In 2023, we passed what became Act 266, a bipartisan bill that would require K-12 public schools to include Asian American history in their curriculum. That was a Republican-led bill that I worked extensively with Representative Pat Snyder from Wausau. We had, I think, a total of 15 Republicans sign on to the bill. Had an amazing coalition of students, parents, teachers, superintendents, small business owners all across the state come to testify at the public hearing, submit letters to members of the Committee on Education. We passed a bipartisan bill on race in 2023, and that's certainly one of my proudest accomplishments.
Is there a Republican you've worked with that you think you could work with again as governor, who you might even say is a friend?
You know, I've had drinks and smoked cigars with Republicans at Maduro. I think having conversations and being persistent about legislation and priorities, you know, changing the environment and where we do that is, it matters. You know, there's a lot of folks, a lot of incumbents who will not be running for re-election. I think I had a very good conversation, and I'm kind of bummed he's not running again, with Representative Rob Brooks on the you know, criminal legal, criminal justice reform. On he owns multiple small businesses as well, and what we need to do in the hospitality industry. I've had a decent working relationship with Representative Joel Kitchens, who's the chair of the Committee on Education. And you know, I hope they would say the same thing about me, is that I'm not scary and as vulgar and, you know, outlandish as some of the folks, a lot of people perceive me as. I want to get shit done. I really want to pass good policy that improves people's lives across our state.
And so maybe Governor Hong would have a cigar summit.
That, and, you know, I don't know if you all saw my latest Bratfest video, but I would love to have the grill outs back. I'm pretty sure Governor Walker would barbecues, or, you know, invite people beer over summit for a grill. That's it. I own a restaurant for 7 years. I'm a great host. I know how to throw a good party, a good gathering, and make sure. I think we deserve to have some joy and fun in our politics. It's needed. And I also want us to focus on innovation and being curious and maybe a little risk tolerant in ensuring that our state agencies and our legislature and the executive branch are working collaboratively to get the most done for the most people in times where folks are facing, you know, just economic crisis when it comes to their budgets at home, in terms of services. And I'm willing to work with anyone to make that happen.
And not to diss Johnsonville, but you could probably make something better than bratwurst for your gatherings, right?
Yeah, there was a whole lot of Johnsonville all across Sproutfest. But, you know, I'm a huge fan of, I love Sloppy Joe's and barbecue meatballs with like the grape jelly. I'm bummed that I'm not seeing more of those when I go to county party meetings. And that I'm not, you know, I used to say, and I guess I still say, that some of the most delicious food is brown food. I'm not out here for bougie things and fancy ketchup and people messing around with tater tots. I like good food. And I think that it doesn't have to be fancy to be good.
If you could get one big thing done as governor in your first term, what would that one big thing be?
Healthy school meals for all. We've got 6% The fact that we have hungry kids in Wisconsin is unacceptable, and hungry kids can't learn. And it's, you know, studies show that when kids are have full tummies, they learn better. They have better test scores. It's less on our educators to buy snacks and out of their own pockets to make sure that their students are fed and ready to learn. And healthy school meals for all is an opportunity to help strengthen partnerships with farmers, making sure that every school in Wisconsin should be serving Wisconsin milk. And that's not the case right now. We've got milk coming in from Iowa in some schools. So that would be huge. And, you know, if we eliminate that manufacturers and agricultural tax credit and save upwards of $400 million a session, that is enough to fund at least three sessions. The last fiscal was about $115 million to fund healthy school meals for all. And it's something that is possible, and I'm going to be working very hard to pass. And just last session, or this session, we got every single Democrat to sign on to that bill.
When Governor Evers ran for governor the first time, we asked him how he would approach Killeen Cares School, one city. And he said, well, I sent them a grant. He was open to public charter schools, including the ones that weren't under a specific school district. Some of them were under the University of Wisconsin. So I guess I'm just wondering, how would a Governor Hong approach Killeen Cares School, one city, which is a public charter school, but it's outside of the Madison School District, and I don't believe it has unionized teachers.
I think it's important that we have strong accountability and transparent metrics for public charters as well. You know, during when schools, our Madison Public Schools, had to absorb students from one city when they shut down their high school, and when we are seeing high turnover rates in their schools when it comes to educators, that we have to look at, you know, where can there be improvements for, you know, public tax dollars to go to a school like One City. And there is a responsibility for vouchers and charters that if they are, you know, relying on philanthropy and private money, that fundraising, that there's accountability and a plan to make sure that they can continue to fund and rely on these private dollars as well. And so I want to prioritize accountability and transparency for all schools. And our public schools are under the scrutiny of both the, you know, they have to follow audits, they have to show metrics, they have to enact additional audits that may be directed from the legislative, joint legislative audit committee. And so the fact that, you know, vouchers don't have to hire licensed teachers, that they can discriminate against students, that there are public dollars going to these private schools that don't have the accountability measures and same standards and metrics as public schools. We need increased accountability there and transparency. And one of the ways we can do that is to show, like they do in Green Bay, on people's property tax reports, that how much of those property tax dollars are going to vouchers. And I think that for, I commend Killeen for trying to be as transparent as he can, but we have to set the metrics in a place where more legislators feel comfortable with those public tax dollars going to schools like One City. And mm-hmm. I'm open to conversations with Killeen, and we haven't been able to connect quite yet, but I'm open.
Why did you vote for the 14 some million for the UW athletic department? Just about every Democrat did, I think, in the assembly. But, in the Senate, it was pretty split. And one of your opponents, Kel DeRoys, did vote against it. So why were you for that money for the athletic department when they seem to be making more money than ever on TV contracts?
I think for me, a lot of the concern was on deferred maintenance. And one of the ways that, you know, we increase dollars for, we have to find as many dollars as we can for our public universities as they become more reliant on private dollars, because we've underfunded our public universities for the last 16 years. And so I had to measure and weigh in on how can we make sure that there are avenues for the program to be able to continue to sustain and make sure that facilities are safe and updated and available for both men and women's sports. But it's, I hope it works more towards equity, that those dollars are going to that.
Scott mentioned Senator Royce. You know, she's running against you in the governor's race. You're both from Madison. You're both going to need to turn out a lot of votes in Madison to win this election, I think. How do you differentiate yourself from Senator Royce in this race? What's the difference?
Well, I identify publicly as a Democratic Socialist. I think she's an incredibly progressive legislator. We, you know, I think that I have a greater appeal to, well, the majority of our support is with Gen Z voters and millennial voters. I don't know exactly what her numbers look like, but I know that certainly differentiates our campaign from a lot of my opponents' campaigns. And I think that, again, there is a message and versus messenger situation here as well. And there isn't as much support right now for career politicians. And I think that being a community organizer as well, somebody who is committed to building progressive power and ensuring that we have a Democratic majority. And I want to make sure that I'm accessible to working class folks from all across the state. I would assume she does as well, but I think we may be prioritizing different communities when it comes to making sure that we're getting and where we're getting support.
If you faced Tom Tiffany for governor, he's going to focus, I'm sure, more on the word socialist than democratic. When you say you're a democratic socialist, he's going to say she's an extremist from the Madison Isthmus who wants to go to socialism, and maybe he'll even throw some other isms out there. So if that line of criticism is wide open from the conservative side anyway, they would see it as criticism. How do you shape up as the best Democrat to beat him in that scenario?
It is extreme that we have hungry kids in our state. It is extreme that we have underfunded public schools and that in rural areas, schools are closing. It is extreme that we have folks across our state who are working 2-3 jobs and still aren't able to get by and have, you know, be able to pay all their bills. Our campaign is building the broad coalition. We are building the big tent. We have Republicans, independents, Democratic Socialists, Democrats, people who don't say they have no political home right now, who are interested and supporting and wanting a different type of politician to lead their state. And the differences between Tiffany and I couldn't be more stark. We have an individual who has been wishy-washy about who won the 2020 election. You know, that's, I mean, you're borderline traitor there. We have someone who is bought by Trump and answers to Trump and not the people of Wisconsin, someone who is a pedophile protector and also against legalizing weed. But, you know, missing votes in Congress, voting for a bill that would gut healthcare and take food away from our kids, his home area in the Northwoods, you know, voting to put natural resources up there at risk and investing in mining and potentially more coal plants, gas plants that are going to threaten communities and their way of life and tourism. Tourism is an important industry in his district, and he seems to have no regard for making sure that people, working class people, all people in Wisconsin are able to live a life where they're not going to be beholden to what happens in the Trump administration. He has no intention of protecting folks. And I think that's why Republicans right now are trying to present him as this, oh, you betcha, nice guy. But you look at his record, you look at how he's voted and how many votes he's missed, and the way that he governs, where his values are so different than what Wisconsinites value. And Wisconsinites deserve so much better.
I imagine you've been all over the state as part of this campaign. What's a place that you would tell our listeners, a lot of them Madison area, like where's a place in Wisconsin that you haven't heard of that you need to go see because it's just a beautiful, exciting, unique place?
Warrens, Wisconsin for the Cranberry Festival and Marinette. I will remember that burger from Mickey Lou's for the rest of my life. And I will never forget an entire town turning into a cranberry festival, shutting down to become a cranberry festival site. And my love for cranberries runs deep. I think everyone needs to go to a cranberry marsh, put on those waders, and see the industry that, you know, we are number one in cranberry production. That is pride and joy.
How about, this should be an easy one for you. We've been asking all of the candidates, what's their favorite supper club? I mean, you're a restaurateur. I'm sure you have many, but really, what is the best supper club in Wisconsin?
I love the Del Bar and the Dells.
Me too. My folks met special. There, actually.
Oh, wow. It's the one place I will order a grasshopper.
And what do you like about it?
Is the history there. You know, that was one of the places we took our staff on our first, you know, staff retreat, spent some time in the Dells, and we had a really nice time. I think when food and your restaurant trip can evoke a memory, you know, that's going to be a place that's a favorite.
Well, thank you so much, Francesca, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Good luck on the campaign trail.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Our theme music is by Tube Tester.